Hey guys, it's your host Julian. This week I'm sitting down with Sylvia Edwards and Larry Huber to chat the very early days of Cartoon Network, Fred Seibert coming aboard and the What a Cartoon initiative, and the animation boom of the 90s. I want to give a special shout out to a couple of our patrons that helped make this podcast possible. Bill, Brent, Brittany, Eight-Legged Bird, Jacob, and Nick. Thank you all so much for your support. It truly means a lot. If you want to become a patron and help support this show, check the show notes below and sign up today. Now, let's get to my chat with Sylvia and Larry. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to What's My Head Podcast. You must join us today. I'm joined by Larry and Sylvia. Folks, welcome to the show. How are you guys?
We're good. Thank you.
Doing fine.
I'm glad to have you, man. Thanks for joining me. So before we dive into what we're talking about today, ladies and gentlemen, we're going to be talking about Cartoon Network in the early days of the What a Cartoon. I had a text message from the great one, Mr. Fred Seibert, and it was about Larry and about Sylvia. I wanted to read it to you guys. So I reached out to him and I asked, hey, man, what's Larry like? And he said, Larry is the greatest. Like a lot of veterans of production, he could act tough on teams because they can have a tendency to be late or lazy, but he has a heart of gold. And he was a dedicated. Honestly, I couldn't have survived doing all of the shorts and series without him. He's the one who convinced me to use David Feast on Two Stupid Dogs and brought him into the shorts program with Cartoon Oh, shit, my eyesight is really starting to go. But brought him into the shorts program. And then he said about Sylvia, he said, you should for sure have Sylvia. He's like, it just came to me. It would be great if you could include Sylvia in the podcast, too. She was a production manager on more than half the eps. She's great and rarely gets any attention. So I had to have both Larry and Sylvia, the dynamic duo, according to Fred. So I wanted to read that to you guys. But hearing that, man, Larry, we'll get Sylvia. Let's start ladies first, Sylvia. When you hear the name Fred Seibert and Cartoon Network, what's the first thought that comes to your mind?
I was just talking with somebody the other day as far as, to me, the Fred, the word is bold. Fred is not afraid to go where nobody else is. As far as the, you know, a lot of people at his level, and I think you would agree with that, as far as at his level, they kind of pull back if there's nobody else over in that neck of the woods. And Fred looks over there and says, hey, there's nobody over there. Let's go over there and make something. It just, he's very consistent with that. And, you know, that would be the word that I would use for Fred. Bold.
Boy, oh boy, is he. Larry, when you think of Fred, what do you think of?
Well, the first time we met Fred was at the... because he was a new guy. Nobody knew who it was. It's another new guy, you know, that's coming on. Coming over from MTV, and that's where he was originally. He comes over here and he steps up, takes over at Hanna-Barbera, and he gets all the group together in the theater in Burbank here. And we got the whole place humming. We've got people up there doing sign language, so that we can include those people. There were a couple that were on staff. And first, one of the things he said that really grabbed me was, it says, first of all, I've never done animation. I have no idea what I'm doing. And now this is from the head of the company, is telling you right out loud that I'm just making it up as I go along. He endeared me to me immediately, said, I've never seen an executive that ever admitted that outright. Of course he lied. He meddled in everything. he said, "Oh, you guys just do your jobs, and I'll throw in notes." But I said, "That's about it." So, but he did much more than that. So yeah, he's the guy.
He absolutely is. He's one of my favorite guests I've ever had on. I've had him on a few times, and each time if you guys remember that line from Shrek, man, you peel back that ogre, he's just got layers. He's like an onion. He's just got layers. And that's all Fred is. Every time I have him on, I'm peeling back a different layer and I'm learning something new about the animation process, the production process, and something. Like I said, you can't ever walk away and you can't ever not listen to Fred and pull at least 10 or 15 things that you should be implementing into your day-to-day to make you more of a successful person. Like I said, he's just a phenomenal person, a phenomenal guest. So with that being said, you guys were there before Fred came on. You know, you guys were still Hanna-Barbera at that time. No, did you start right after?
I was just finishing up an internship when Fred came on board. of internship at Hanna-Barbera, and Fred came on at the tail end of that internship. But I was not a staff member yet.
What was it like for you as an intern? I haven't had too many people on that started as an intern at Hanna-Barbera and then rotate into a full-time staff member.
I always say that I was when I talk with people, I say I was an elderly intern.
younger than I.
I had been a teacher for several years, and was always interested in production from the time I was a little kid. And I decided finally that I was going to take a year sabbatical and do something related to film, television. I didn't know what, get an internship or an entry level job. And just kind of, you know, I took classes before that, like one class each semester at night that had to do with film and television, and then decided I just want to be in a studio somewhere, and did cold calls to different studios that I recognized, where I recognized the name, and I got as far as the H's and called Hanna-Barbera and said, do you take, you know, interns that are, I didn't want to go back to university for the internship credit. I was taking classes through a community college. And I said, do you take, you know, community college interns? And they said, sure. And she's Leanne is the person who sent me my application. And she asked me questions about what I was looking for. And I said, I'd like to work in the children's programming if that's possible. And she said, well, she sent it. I filled it out, sent it back. She called me a couple of days later and said, can you come in for an interview with Margot McDonough? Mm-hmm. And she's in our development area. And I said, okay. And I went and interviewed with Margot, and Margot chose me to be her intern. And strangely enough, the thing I was working on, it wasn't called this at the time, but it was the seed part of what was going to be What a Cartoon.
Oh, wow.
Sending out information to different art departments and colleges, to a flyer that went out and said, we're having this contest. If you're interested, here's how to get in touch. It requires, I think it was a 50-page storyboard or 50 panels. I don't remember what it was, but it gave a little outline. And I did cold calls to the different departments at different colleges all over the U.S. and asked, can we send you this batch of flyers? We're going to have this contest. It's a storyboard contest. Do you think your students would be interested? And that was my internship, was doing those calls.
Wow. No wonder Craig. No wonder Fred said, you know, you were an integral part of all of this. And that's just wild, because I didn't know that's what it was when I've talked and done as much research as I possibly can on the What a Cartoon, the cartoon era, especially when Fred took over and, you know, Ted Turner and bought everything and they really started pushing the original programming. I just assumed it was a lot like college sports. Like, so you would have these professional scouting go out and go look at all these campuses, and I just figured it would be CalArts and a lot of things like that. So all of these guys would just send talent, you know, talent scouts out and look, that guy looks good, that guy looks good, she looks like she could do some really, really cool stuff with her art. And I thought that's how they all came to Cartoon Network or Nickelodeon. I didn't know that's how you guys got your footing, just cold calling and sending people flyers and say, hey, we're trying to get people in here. That's very smart. It's kind of like what I do now. I just go on social media and find as many people about animation and they want to talk to me and they worked on some really cool cartoons. Hey, you want to talk to me? Nope, cool, I'll go to the next person until I find somebody that says yes. For every one person, or for every fucking 10 people that say no, there's always one person person that'll say yes, you know what I mean? So I've found myself very lucky in that sense. So I took a page out of Sylvia's book, and I didn't realize I took a page out of Sylvia's book. Look at that.
It wasn't my page. I was just the intern and following instructions. And Margot, you know, that's what she explained, that they were doing this contest. And that's what she needed, you know, that's why she wanted an intern, is somebody that she could turn it over to and just do the cold calls.
You weren't paid at all for that either.
Not well, I was paid with being I was in a studio, yeah. That I was so, I
She
was,
understood the value of that.
I was over the moon because I grew up with, you know, Hanna-Barbera. And, you know, Hanna-Barbera cartoons, and being in a studio, and it just had this feeling to it. And Margot was a great intern supervisor. She, you know, that was my job as an intern, was doing that. But the other part, I mean, she put me into all different departments so I could talk with people who worked there at the studio. And what do? And I thought I wanted to be a writer at the time. That's what I was thinking, to move into that arena, or, you know, I didn't know it was called development, but in that area. And just that exposure to production made me feel like, hey, this is fun over here. And I didn't feel quite the same way about the writing part of it. Writers were very nice, but I thought, wow. I don't know if I want to be a writer after all on a show. And it was very different. And I that's where I got a chance to see Larry coming back and forth. And usually what he wanted was help with the copy machine. And but getting a chance to, you know, meet different people and what they did, from editing, through, you know, storyboard, the writers. I got a chance to talk with writers who were on shows, and, you know, very honest with me about the nature of it. You think it's one way because it sounds like, you know, a certain way. And then when you talk with somebody who does it as a day-to-day, you have a whole different feeling about it. And for me, every time I got a chance to help with production, because they Margot had me sit in the production area, this area where all of the, at the time they were all called production assistants, but different ranges of ability, but Margot had me sit in that area, so I got a chance to see them doing their work. If they had something, I had finished my, you know, cold calls for the day, and they needed some help with something, I was able to jump in and help them with whatever the production thing is. And that's how I just became so attached to that particular side of things. That was, you know, it was a good fit for me, I think.
Well, that's really cool. Just getting to hear your journey from unpaid intern to finally making that staff. That's just really cool. I like seeing those grassroots beginnings, you know what I mean? Just flourishing, you coming in, you think you want to do one thing, and you realize, like, no, I don't really want to do that, but there's all these doors and these avenues to animation that I absolutely love when people find what they're looking for.
Yeah. And the unpaid intern to me is a misnomer. I understand why they want people to, you know, get some sort of a financial thing, but for me, like Larry was saying, that exposure to that world, there's no other way to do it except to be in the studio.
Well, that's beautiful, man, and thank you for sharing that story. So you know, switching it back over to you, Larry, you know, obviously you'd been in the industry for quite some time at that point, you know, and then Fred comes in and says, I don't know what I'm doing, I need help, I need you guys to do your job, I'm gonna do my job. So when I started looking at your resume, you know, you'd been all over before, but, you know, Cartoon Network really started to become Cartoon Network. Those first couple shows, you know, you had Two Stupid Dogs, and that's how David Feast kind of comes on. And then you had SWAT Cats coming around about that same time. And when I had Fred on, Fred had said those two were a commercial flop, essentially. just taking money out of it. I absolutely loved those two shows. I always tell this story. When SWAT Cats was on, there was a couple shows that my younger brother and I had like a complete ceasefire right? There was no wars going on in the house. There was no brothers fighting. There was nobody choking each other because SWAT cats were on. So you guys gave my mom about a 30-minute reprieve of trying to pull her two sons apart from trying to kill each other, man, just to watch this one cartoon together. And then Two Stupid Dogs, he didn't like it as much as I did, so he kind of went off and did his own thing. But I was just enamored by these two shows. So what about you? When Fred comes on and says, I've got this great idea, man, what's going through Larry? I know that's a long time ago, and I can't remember what I did last week, let alone what I did 30 years ago. But what was that first initial meeting like? What was that first feeling like when Fred says, this is what we're going to do with What a Cartoon?
Well, the first of all, when Fred first came on, I was already a producer in the shows. I was working with the regular studio intern stuff, including Crazy Squirrel. That was the first. This one here was an old Hanna-Barbera show.
Screwy Squirrel,
I guess it was.
Okay.
And that goes back to the MGM days, I mean, almost. Yeah. So they were trying to get it started again.
All right, as we take a pause for the cause, if you haven't yet, you should check us out on all social media platforms by searching at In My Head Pod. There you can see who we've got coming on, and if you feel so inclined to, you could submit a question to be asked. Now, let's get back to the show.
And I got a hold of one of those things, and I did the storyboard on the thing, and I wrote it, and I turned it into Bill Hanna. And I had, not Bill Hanna, but Joe Barbera. I had never met Joe before until recently. I knew his daughter, Jane Barbera, but I had never met Joe. And she was shocked that I had not met Joe, which was her father. She says, well, let's go talk to Joe. So she went and says, you'll love Joe. Everybody loves Joe. And I said, okay. She says, well, note to self, be sure to love Joe. And Joe was very, very funny. And he loves to talk, and he loves to talk to people, and he loves to tell people how wonderful he is. And he was. He was a great guy. Bill Hanna, on the other hand, was the producer. He's the guy who was hammer fell. And I worked with him a lot of times, too, where we'd go into his room, and he said, okay, now you get all these layouts and take them home, and there's going to be so many dollars an hour or foot. I guess it's for layout. So I mean, a piece. And so I went back there like that. And oh my God, it was so much work for so little money. I remember coming back, I was working at home. I went in and I said, okay. And I was really upset. I said, Joe or Bill, look, I said, I'm done. I'm not working on this show anymore. I said, I can't. It's just too low. I said, my God. I said, it's a show that takes place in a circus. I said, the crowd itself takes me forever to draw. He says, then you got trapeze artists and big, strong guys. You know, that's a terrible, I'm not doing it anymore. So I'm sorry, I did the work. I did all the work. I turned it in. It's completely complete. There's nothing incomplete, but I'm not taking that job again. Not for the money you're paying me. So he says, how much for this much? This is why did you offer me that to begin with? And he says, well, if I had, then he would have taken the lesser amount. And that was my lesson in producing right there. And so I got along fine with Bill, you know. And never, like I said, I never knew Joe until recently. So, but yeah, and when I was on the Screwy Squirrel, Joe said to me, he said, he looked at what I did and they said, oh, I had a gag. And I picked this up from Warner Brothers. Well, it says they had a gag where the guy was setting something to catch the guy, whatever. I forgot what the story was, and he set landmines, and they go off, boom, 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 and you covered with soot. Then he go back and try it again, and boom, because he could never get the guy that way. First thing Joe says was, can't do landmines, can't do landmines, and so. It's a great gag, great funny, very funny, funny, funny gag, but can't have that. So rather than rewrite the whole story, what I did was I did the same gag, but instead of landmines, they were bubblegum traps. All of a sudden, the guy would go and he'd come hanging off a tree, and the other guy would go and slap him and walk on. So that got through. Okay, but so you got to work it. That was Joe. But it wasn't until Fred came in, did the talk at the studio, because everybody was wondering, who's this guy? You know, aren't we going to work for Bill and Joe anymore? Is Jane still going to be there? It was very messy because Joe Barbera and Hanna-Barbera was a studio shop. I mean, they're just a family business, you know. So the guys that they had on staff have been there since MGM days. They were there a long time. So getting a gig in there was nice. Okay, but I had already worked for 15 years at another shop. And it was, I got brought over there when they brought a new producer in. So, and I got picked up there. But so that it, but Sylvia, when I needed a producer or some, I knew what I needed was somebody to sit in a writer's room and take down the notes. Mm-hmm. Okay. Because they were pitching gags back and forth. And we needed somebody that was going to pitch the gag. So I walked by the PA department, you know, and they all looked like they were like 14 years old. I mean, the whole group of them, they were all college students, you know, and smiley faces like this. And Sylvia had a smiley face, but it was honest. And I said, who's this old woman in the midst of all these young pups? So I asked her.
Elderly intern.
I know you just said you were an intern. And I went, an intern of where, you know? And she said, oh, okay, well, can you run off some copies for me? Sure. So she did that and brought them back. And after a while, I needed somebody that was able to take notes in a writer's room. That's when I was working in Two Stupid Dogs. And so I went up to Sylvia and I said, look, what was that thing?
You keep telling the story.
Well, that's the way I remember it.
No, I was taking notes, but he always says that, can you take shorthand?
Yeah, that's what I said. Can you do shorthand? Like that. And she goes, I can take notes. So that was her answer. And I went with that. And then later on, I said, you don't take shorthand. She wrote everything out on a long yellow tablet like this. And of course the writers loved it because basically they just typed it up. And they had this almost as
soon as they got done. I did take I was an ex-school teacher, so I taught for several years. I could, you know, my handwriting was really good. Take those, run off the copies. They had the notes the same day they had their meeting.
Then I needed an actual PA. When the show got started and up and running. And
my internship was coming to an end.
As it turned out, anyway. So I went to Margot because she would actually work for Margot. She's very good. Well, you got to ask Margot. So I talked to Margot. I'm like, sure, you can have her. Because you had to find someplace for her because she was leaving, right? So didn't tell me that. But anyway, so I said, okay, fine. I just took her up and put her down a payroll and started her up. Oh, my God, I made a big mess that way. You can't put somebody like that immediately in the payroll. You have to put it on the board and advertise it as an opening of the job pool and blah, blah, blah. So I said, so she's already online. So I've already got it working. She's already working for me and she should get paid. And whatever the starting rate is for this stuff. And they said, well, you can't do that. So I got a slap in the hand by Jane Barbera.
Jane was the one who called me and said, I understand that Larry would like to have you as his assistant. And I said, yeah. Are you interested in that job? And I said, yeah. And she said, well, you know, I'll chat with Larry, but sounds good to me. So Jane Barbera was the one who was the executive who gave the final okay. The
blessing.
Yeah.
Jane liked my gags. So I think so.
Yeah.
I remember one time I just came onto the studio. That was about in the early 90s when I came back to the studio. I had this full beard, and I said, I wonder what it looked like without the beard. So I shaved my face right down the middle here. All the stuff was gone. All the stuff was left. And I'm sitting down at my desk, and Jane comes in. She's heard it. It's on the record. She comes in. I knew why she was there. Hi, Jane. Tell me, how do you like me? You like me with this beard? You know, then I turned around the chair until I came back. I said, well, like this. And she went, And then she says, Larry, thank God you're back. She said, oh my God, I can't tell how much I've missed you. I said, she said, everybody here is so corporate now. And, you know, nobody makes jokes. Nobody writes those tiny cartoons that you have to hide so nobody sees them. I said, I know those. They used to pin them up on the wall.
That's a podcast.
Yeah, itself. Yeah, I'm not going to go into that in detail like that. But
studio by studio, all of them did it.
And so you don't go. Anyway, I won't even go to that. So anyway, that's how I got Sylvia on board. So what an asset she is.
On Two Stupid Dogs and Super Secret Secret School. That was my first actual job in.
Can you guys see him? Super secret squirrel's right over there. Right over there. I'll take a picture of the whole wall and I'll send it to you guys through email. Because it's not done. I've got probably like a third of the way done because it's gonna go down a little bit and it's gonna stretch back and forth. So I've been doing it for about a year. It's not like I'm drawing anything, I'm just popping it up on the wall with a projector and going out. But I've never really drawn on a wall before. It's pretty difficult when it's not a flat wall. It's got all these different textures. So I've had to find the right marker to go.
That's a whiteboard, isn't it?
What's
that? Whiteboard. It's a whiteboard.
No, that's a wall. That's the wall.
Oh.
Yeah, that's the wall. Yeah, it took some convincing to talk my wife into letting me draw with permanent marker and stuff on the board.
I was just going to ask.
Yeah. I didn't have to ask.
Thank you.
No, but I want to circle back to you for just a second, Sylvia. But what was that feeling like when Larry comes and says, I got to work with this lady? What was it like getting that first paycheck from Cartoon Network? What was it like finally being like a member of the team? You had obviously been an intern for quite some time at that point, I'm sure. But like, what was it like to be like, now I'm putting on my Cartoon Network or my Hanna-Barbera shirt today. I'm going to go into work here now. I changed my career.
Well, number one, they didn't have Cartoon Network or any kind of, they did not do swag at Hanna-Barbera when I started. I had started there as an intern in September. Mm-hmm. So, and then the semester was up in December. Larry talked with me somewhere in that December saying that he could use somebody the writers were hammering me to find somebody to take notes in the writing sessions. And so this was a 1 year sabbatical, and it started in, I stopped teaching in June of 92. Mm-hmm. I had another internship within the district where I worked. And then in September for the summer, and then in September, I did my cold calls to studios, and Hanna-Barbera said, yes, come on board. Started in September and worked through. And I was thinking to myself, I still had, the rest of the year left to do this, adventure of interning. Or getting an entry level position. So I had several more months left before. And I thought, well, maybe I'll talk with Margot about letting me do another semester internship. Maybe she'll say yes to that. I didn't know for sure. I didn't get a chance to talk with her about it. Because this came up, an entry level position. So it was like, yes, I will do that. But you're right. As far as for me, and again, I was a teacher for 13 and a half years. And so for me, this was like a dream come true. I'm actually working in a studio, and now they're going to pay me to work in a studio, not that they had to, because I was going to be an intern again if I could, maybe in another department if Margot couldn't have me where I was. But it did. It really, for me, felt like this rush, and I was going to be in the writer's room, so I was going to find out a little bit more about what it's like to be, you have two staff writers on the show, and then everybody else who came in was a freelance writer for Two Stupid Dogs and Secret Swirl.
And one of those freelance writers was Dave Feese.
No, he was a storyboard artist.
Yeah, but I mean.
But these are your two staffers were Mark Saraceni.
Yes.
And Rob Sganaway. And just, and for me, they were so helpful and just kind of like one of Mark's things was, you know, just remember, Sylvia, if you're a writer on a show, the producer is always right. And and I
she just, never learned that. She never learned that.
Well, I thought to myself, well, except maybe Larry. Yeah, that's what but the, you know, just very encouraging as far as like and still asking me, you know, are you sure you want to be a writer? And, you know, and then getting a chance to do some of the production stuff on the show, like to getting, you know, taking in storyboards, and then they would put them, like Larry was saying, put them up on the wall so they could do their story. What do you call that? Where the pitching. Board artist talks about what they've done.
Pitching. They're pitching the story.
I thought you said pitching.
No. There was plenty of that, but that's not what I said.
I thought, that's right. But they are pitching what they've done, and they get notes from the writers, from Larry, from Donovan, you know, whoever the showrunner people are. So
we had great storyboard writers slash on the shows, and
but yes, David was, he did the storyboards.
Yeah, he was great.
Super Secret, some of my favorite Super Secret Squirrel. I love Super Secret Squirrel.
I do.
Were David's episodes where you laugh at the board. It doesn't have to be, you know, a cartoon yet at all. You just picture it in your head.
Well, I'm glad that you liked the Two Stupid Dogs. I told Donovan when we first got together, and Donovan asked for me actually what it was. he had a little office there, and I was going through the studio from hither and yon, and I came across the drawing on the wall of Two Stupid Dogs, and it was totally unlike any places we were going with this stuff. SWAT Cats was more like the traditional way it was going, but Donovan Cook stuff looked totally off the wall. And I just said to somebody that was working on it, I said, this is great. He says, it looks like, you know, the old
there's Ward Kimball.
No.
Oh, Jay Ward.
More like the old Jay Ward stuff.
Okay.
And so, or UPA, I said, and I love that stuff. And at that time, the producers that were on staff there were old animators from way, way back when. And they didn't like all these young guys coming on board. They don't call me a young guy, but they didn't like people coming and taking their jobs, you know, like that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
You know, I didn't have any way about it, but I like what I liked. So I just set it up out loud to them, have to think it going. I wasn't planning it for very much. Mm-hmm. Next thing I go, I get a call from Fred Seiber. Come in. I've heard good things about you.
Can you tell me some of those good things?
I'm trying to just keep living with it. The only producer that ever came to my room was Jean Barbera, you know, and she was a production manager. So, I mean, they said that, yeah, these young kids coming in here, we got these shows coming in. We're trying to get a lot of new faces, a lot of new people. And he needed to come on board as his producer, because I think some of the other producers, and yeah, well, let me tell you, it's not going to be so easy to get in there. And you're going to have to do a lot of work. And what I say goes like that. Well, that scared a lot of Donovan. And but as it went on, Donovan and I probably had I told Donovan coming in, I've been in the business 20 years at this point. I said, and I've got that much information stored up in overhand, and I'm willing to dump all that into your head. You can fumble through it all you want to, take out what you like, and use what you need. Okay. Boy, he couldn't hear anything better than that. As it came out, we went back and forth quite a bit. And we both ended up in Fred's office complaining about the other person, and to be honest with you. And So I finally said, look, why don't we just split the picture? He gets two, the show is called Two Stupid Dogs. That's his show. It's the one he designed. You're pulling an old show, Secret Squirrel, out of the box and redoing it back up again. I see that you've started up some sketches and stuff, and that's great. Why don't you just give me two stupid dogs to do? Or you got to give Donovan two stupid dogs, and I'll do the Secret Squirrel stuff. Because once you incorporate them all into animal characters, because before that it was Super Secret or Secret Squirrel, and everybody else was humanoid. They were human characters. Mm-hmm. I never thought that worked for me. But let's just turn them all into animals. So it's a society of animals. It's basically Zootopia, you know, and you go it that way. And so that's the way we took it. And so I went off and did that. But Donovan still had feedback on everything. After a while, he just let me go. And that's why I liked it so much. First of all, Secret Squirrel couldn't be produced that way because it needed a different name. Mm-hmm. Similar to, but not the same as Secret Squirrel. So that's how it ended up being Super Secret Squirrel on the added stuff. But glad you worked it out. And if you probably didn't like my show. You don't have to say it if you don't like it. I'll sit here and putter with it.
Oh, no. I enjoyed it because that was the first. So when I was younger, you know, I would spend the summers up with my grandparents up in West Virginia, and we watched a lot of Turner Classic movies. My grandpa was that guy that could watch a movie and then like halfway through, he's like, did you know she played in X, Y, and Z? And she's like, did you know he directed this, that, and the other? So subconsciously, he was the guy that was instilling in me to look at these actors, these actresses, these people that wrote the movies, the directors, and look at the names, right? So it wasn't until, you know, a few years later when I start watching cartoons, my mom's working two jobs, my dad's out of the picture now at this point. So I'm sitting here and I'm watching cartoons when my mom's at work and my older sister's supposed to be watching me, and I start seeing these names pop up like Gendy and David and John R. Dilworth and Danny Antonucci, you know, just going Craig Bartlett when on the Nickelodeon side. So just seeing all of these names, it wasn't just Walt Disney for me anymore. Walt Disney was the guy that started my fandom. I'm sure, you know, everybody gets put in front. There's a story my big sister likes to tell. And she's, I think she's 6 years. Yeah, she's 6 years older than me. So she likes to say whenever I was a baby and I would really, really start having one of those meltdowns as a baby, they would stick me in front of the Little Mermaid from Walt Disney. And then I would just shut up and I would just be amazed at all the cartoons. So that's kind of where, you know, as far as they go with my cartoon fandom, that's where it starts, you know, but it doesn't get solidified until I see that white and black checkerboard scrolling across my screen going cartoon, cartoon, what a cartoon Friday, Cartoon Network this, Cartoon Network that. And that's when I start seeing these names. Now, I had seen Cow and Chicken, I had seen Dexter, I'd seen Powerpuff Girls. And then I've never been a guy that's could go to sleep. I'm always that one that stays up ridiculously late for no reason just because I can't shut my brain off. So I would watch cartoons very, very late when everybody was sleeping. And they would do reruns late at night of Two Stupid Dogs. And I can remember seeing David Feast in those credits. And I was like, whoa, this is Cowan. Is this, did he have a brother? What is this? You know, and this is when it started to build that curiosity. Like, oh my God, these guys and gals, they work on more than one show. So I loved Super Secret, Secret Squirrel. I loved Two Stupid Dogs. I loved SWAT Cats and everything else that Cartoon Network had put out at that point. You know, so getting to see that, and then you get to see these flashbacks when they were producing. Jay Ward Productions is one of my favorite studios of all time. The Moose That Roared is my favorite animation book on history of all time. You know, I got to talk to the author of that not too long ago. Fascinating person and great dude too. You know, so I loved what you guys did. Now, when you guys are working on Two Stupid Dogs, obviously you said you guys are going back and forth. You know, you wanted this, he wanted that. It was his show, so you wanted to do the Super Secret Squirrel stuff. Was there any, once that relationship kind of started to fracture, was there anything that like kind of helped mend that fences? Are you guys at a better spot now, you know, 30 years down the road after Two Stupid Dogs?
I don't think that Donovan's ever said a bad word about me that I know of, that I've reported back. And I've never said a bad word about Donovan. Donovan was the first kid, the kid that came into the studio with a project that looked great. And I think he ran it well. We just it's more of a dry humor, the way that show ran. It didn't have a lot. I'm a slapstick kind of guy. So that's why the two shows were
that's a good description.
Yeah, the two were very different. I mean,
the approach is different.
Yeah, and so it's this broad comedy, whereas his had a lot more of a stand-up routine type of comedy on his show. But yeah, he went on. But just having said that, I would say he would never work at Disney, and next thing you know, he's over at Disney. And in fact, it's one of his first shows was Nightmare Ned.
Yeah.
Nightmare Ned. I liked Nightmare Ned. I thought that was a great show coming out of Donovan. Well, not just coming out of Donovan. It was a great show.
So, and he was really supportive of, like, he could have, even though, you know, again, being the elderly intern, I'm going to say it a lot because I think you will hesitate. But it's really, I was like almost 20 years older than those kids that were, you know, coming through. And Donovan could have said, well, you know, I really would rather have somebody, you know, she's in production, I understand that, and I'd rather have somebody who's a little closer to our age. And he never did that. He was always very supportive of
that's good.
Like, you know, me being there and very supportive and again, Larry liked having me on board because Larry's old, like, you know, like me.
He's throwing you under the bus, Larry.
We could talk about things that, you know, both of us grew up hearing. That whole team, have you seen that image? The photograph of, we're sitting in the Flintstone-mobile.
Yeah.
It's possible. Whenever I do my research, I go and look at any photo that's up there and the interview you guys might have had.
A copy. I'll send the link to you.
Matter of fact, everybody who's worked with me any length of time that has drawn a picture, drew a picture of me. I mean, everybody wants to take a crack at me, and I guess I have a face that's just people want to beat up,
including David.
David Face drew a couple of cartoons.
He's got some good ones.
Yeah, and I'll send you those. There's a couple of, and you just show them to David. He'll laugh. Okay. Oh, I remember when I did that. Blah blah blah. Fact is, Dave did one of the. I have several pictures of that Dave drew of me, and all of them are insulting. But I have a lot of insulting cartoons, as a matter of fact, that people have drawn of me. Fact is, one guy who drew a decent drawing, he had called it the wall of Huberosities. And they're all different cartoon drawings of me. But Dave Feast did some of the greatest. One of them he did was of Sylvia and I working together in a story room, and the story guys are all going crazy. They're throwing paper airplanes at each other. They're swinging off of lamps like this, and Sylvie's over there trying to type and looking, don't fall on her. And I just lean in like this and do a grin like that. That's his take on the way we did storyboards. The stories actually at the show.
Actually, comes pretty close to the way.
Why Sylvie was so good. Sylvie, I don't know whether you know, but she didn't say this, but she taught elementary school to the deaf.
Mm-hmm.
So she is a many talented person, but when I heard that she had that, and I had a whole room full of young people that never heard a word I said, that this is the perfect woman to translate everything over in that direction. So,
well, that's really cool. And the reason we do, I told Sylvia this through email. The reason we do both video and audio is because I can't remember the number because I've had quite a few people reach over, and we're going into year four doing this podcast, and I've had people from all walks of life, all religions, all races, all colors, all ethnicity, all everything. And the one thing that I was blown away by, and I'm pretty sure what you guys work in animation for as long as you have, you've seen this, but I just wasn't expecting this. There was a huge population that had reached out that was mentally challenged, whether it was autistic, Down syndrome. And then there was another big population that reached out that have lost their eyesight when they were young, they lost their hearing when they were born, or they lost their hearing as they got older. So there is a group of people that will watch it because they can read subtitles because they can't hear. They can read our lips as long as the videos aren't choppy and my face isn't being blocked by my microphone. I apologize, but we do put the subtitles in there now. But, you know, so we started just doing the video, and then it was quite a few people says, I can't see. I have to hear. So can you guys just put out the audio? The YouTube's okay, but it's just like, I want to be able to hear you guys better because we weren't releasing audio. And there was quite a few people that had just reached out. I never knew, right? Because I just thought animation was just that it was a visual medium. So I just assumed, you know, everybody sees this stuff. Just that moment just never sunk in until I had quite a few of those messages. And I was like, shit, I got to put this out here for everybody so everybody can see it, because animation is for everybody. It's not just for kids. It's not just for adults. I mean, there are age levels for certain things you want to show your kids, but for the most part, animation's for everybody. You know what I mean? So yeah, when I told Sylvia that, and she told me she had taught school for the deaf, and I was like, oh, that is so cool. I wanted to go deeper into it, but I figured we could talk about it, you know, when we got on the podcast.
That was a perfect time. I need a podcast.
Absolutely, man. We're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back. All right. So we're just about done with Two Stupid Dogs, and then we're going to rotate into David Feast and Cow and Chicken. Now, you said David had some very fantastic cartoons about you, Larry, that he had pinned up and he had sent to you. With that being said, you meet a very young David Feast, right? When do you know this guy's got it? When do you know, like, this guy's sensibility, his humor, his artwork, his work ethic, this guy's going to go really, really far? Did it hit quickly?
It hit quickly once I got a look at his actual drawing ability. Mm-hmm. He knew all about storyboards. But David Feast I met when he was, believe it or not, 17, I think.
Wow.
He came into the business at 17. He had been working out of, what's the name of it?
Sacramento.
No, that wasn't. Oh. But it's the prison up there.
Oh, Folsom.
Folsom. He wasn't.
Oh, he lived in Folsom.
David lived in Folsom. Not there. He wasn't in. He wasn't in
prison.
Access family. But
just to be clear,
he got parole.
not quite. But that's where he ended up living. I don't know what where his parents were to start with, but anyway, mm-hmm. he answered the call when they were looking for new talent and stuff. Mm-hmm. At that time, I was at Hanna-Barbera, and I was working in the layout department in animation, where we prepare all the artwork before it goes over to an animator, and then from mm-hmm. that point, it goes to the various departments.
I'm going to jump in but this is before there is what a cartoon or anything. He knew him years before that. Okay.
Obviously, Sylvie didn't know I knew him, so here it is. anyway, so I'm working in the layout department, and he has a spot in the layout department just because they had a desk, but he wasn't part of my layout department. All he did, but while we were doing that kind of stuff, everything was done by pencil then, you know, we had incandescent lights. I mean, it wasn't anything, nobody had a computer. We did all our Xerox work, but there was no such thing as Xerox work at that time, except for Xeroxing on cell. But we used those things that blew up things on a...
Oh, the enlarger. Yes.
Yeah, so that all that was done by hand. And also the fact is, not everybody had a telephone. I had a telephone in my room because I was a supervisor. Okay. Dave had no telephone, but there was a telephone on the wall, probably just outside his thing. But every time he took a call, he'd take it in my room. and I said, hello. I said, Dave Feast. Dave Feast? He leaves this number? Hold on. So I call him over and he comes in. Now I have to sit there and listen to it. Hello. Yeah. Yeah, what's going on? You want to come on? You know, I'd like to play basketball after all of that shit. I put up with this two or three times. Listen, Feast. I said, I don't want you to take the goddamn phones. And you got a phone outside. That's for everybody. You just put that number down and they'll call you and you can go to the wall and do your conversation there. Well, it's not very private. Exactly. Exactly. It's not very private. Get your skinny little ass out of here. So I was a nice guy to work with, but boy, that really pissed me off.
I hadn't heard that.
Well, then it will, then you'll pretty know that we up on that that wall of Huberosities, there's a picture of me growling over my telephone like this.
Oh, that's why.
Yeah, that's David guarding his. I am guarding my phone against that damn little frog he ever did like this. And it was bothering me. Wrote sorry. Okay. That made it up. But I remembered that kid.
Well, David's humor, David's humor is, oh man. So the first time I met him, and I've only met, like, I'm meeting you guys. I've met him through Zoom, and it was like one of the first, I banked like 15 or 20 episodes before I ever released one. Cause I was afraid how my voice sounded. I was afraid how I looked. I was like, I don't want anything to be too harsh. I talked to all these people and I knew I wasn't very good. You know, I'm still getting better, but I like, the first time David comes up, like I treated him like a gorilla at the zoo. You don't look at him. You look down. So for like the first, you know, 5 or 6 minutes before we're hitting record, I'm like, yes, David, I'm a really big fan of you remember Cow and Chicken? He's like, yeah. I was like, I really like, you remember that skit with Chris Farley and SNL where he's got, Paul McCartney. He's got Paul on there. He's like, Paul, you remember the Beatles? And he's like, yeah. He's like, yeah, it was pretty cool. And that's what it felt like with David. I just kept going like, remember when you did that with Boneless? Yeah, that was pretty cool. Luckily, I did all of that weird nervous shit before I hit record, so it didn't really make it in there. But I was so nervous talking to this guy because this guy built my childhood. I mean, it was one of those foundational pieces. I'll go down and say I think Boneless Chicken is one of the funniest characters of all time. Right, he's a chicken tender, right? And the fact that he's cousin Boneless Chicken, and there's so many things that I'll forget by the time I get to my later years in life. I'm never going to forget that episode where they treated him like a boomerang and they threw him up on the roof and he just cooked like a chicken, right? I'm never going to remember that part where he dried out like a piece of jerky. You know what I mean? It's just these little fragments that you guys helped create and you guys helped mold and you guys helped put out there are like forever ingrained in my brain, just seeing that boneless chicken sitting up on that roof, drying out like a piece of jerky, man. So I got to know. What's that?
It's all David Feast.
Oh, yeah. The guy is a genius. I mean, he is hilarious. Just getting to talk to him, I'm like, this dude isn't. And I'm not saying anybody's dumb that I've ever had on, but I was like, I'm talking to this guy. I'm like, I'm too dumb to be talking to him. This man is intelligent. He's funny. He can draw. I'm like, David, what can't you do? I mean, it seems like you can do everything you set your feet to, your hands to. But, you know, when he's doing Cow and Chicken and he's telling me these stories, I'm just blown away. But obviously you knew his humor through his drawings and his interactions with you and your phone that you tried to guard as his picture depicted and stuff. But like, when do you see like him flourish with Cow and Chicken? Obviously, you know, you said he started out really good with Super Secret Squirrel and Two Stupid Dogs. You saw his sensibility, his humor, but when do you start seeing Cow and Chicken pop up?
Well, I asked him, we were doing calls again, and I knew David. And I liked his work because we'd seen it on, you know, Secret Squirrel, and I said, well, that's a guy I want to get on this
shorts
thing.
They had no name.
So I called him up, where in the hell he was in the
Sacramento
area, and I got him on the phone. I said, look, David, it's Larry Huber. He said, oh yeah, Larry, what's going on? Blah blah blah. I said, you know, we were putting together a shorts program here. I said, we'd like to have you give a shot at it. We come up with a 7-minute short of your choosing, you know, drawing your way. You think you'd be able to do that? Oh, yeah. As a matter of fact, I've been thinking about a show called Cow and Chicken because I really like cows and chickens. Okay. Well, why don't you give that a shot and send it on here? Okay, I will. I'm kind of working on it, so I'll just send it over to you. So, all right, boom. So. Now, this is where years later, when you're going talking about origin stories and stuff, mm-hmm. everybody gets into the things that I was the one that did that first. I was the one that put that guy there. I'm the one that hired him. So this is where I heard it. I don't know that anybody else was in it, but I know that the development department went up there to meet with David. Oh. I don't know if it was earlier or later than that. But they're the ones that said, oh, no, we met with him. And he came up with the story right there in the spot. Said, so I don't know who made the first phone call or David Feast got him down there. But obviously the rest is just history. I mean, yeah. But it was.
So and you did that with more than one person. Oh, you had seen, you know, there were like he had seen Gindy's student film. And as far as like, you need to. They're doing this shorts thing. You need to,
I need to write this whole thing down in a little book.
You need to put this, something together and try to pitch something. You know, as far as like with people that he felt, you know, you can do this. You can come up with something that's funny.
Well, people
just send something in, send it to the development department. I don't remember if they got flyers. And again, I may have been. Like when you started talking with David, I was probably still an intern and just sending flyers to, giving addresses to have flyers sent. I didn't actually send them. Came up with the addresses.
That's when we had a development department. After Fred got the shorts started, he stopped the development department. He wanted all the stuff to come directly from the horse's mouth. Mm-hmm. And so that was part of that initial fight for. Which I don't want to call it a fight because the man's my boss.
Fluctuation thing. But the
origin tales.
But they pitched stuff to the development part. People who sent stuff in where they thought, well, let's consider this. By then, I would have been on Two Stupid Dogs, not doing any kind of whatever addresses I gave to Margot had long since they sent out flyers and.
Yeah.
People had started sending stuff back. But of the ones that Larry worked with the kids on Two Stupid Dogs, there were things that he saw of their work. He said, you need to get this, get into the shorts program. You can, this is really, it's the seed of something that can go on. It's the kind of stuff they're looking for. Think about putting something together. And some of them did. Not everybody, but some of them did. Put together stuff that they could go and pitch.
But what are you guys' initial thoughts of like when Cow and Chicken gets picked up? Well, let's start at the pilot. What are you guys' initial thoughts of that pilot when you see all these things that David's boarding?
It's the interesting thing about pilot, and I think I don't know how well this is known. Dave Feast animated most of the
book. Oh, yeah.
As opposed to later on when you're going down through a series and stuff like that, you can't take the leisure of doing that. You've got to give that away. As a matter of fact, a lot of our work went overseas for the bulk of the work because of the animation. We pull certain shows back, or we do certain things on a certain show here because we couldn't trust it to anybody else. But the people that came on from mostly Cal Arts at that time were some exceptional people. Gandhi, for example, is Craig McCracken.
Rob Renzetti came from there.
Alex Kerwin,
Randy Myers, Scott Wills. There was a lot of people. Yeah,
we got them all over there, and they all did a short for the most part, or they got picked up to work on the shorts. Craig and Paul Rudish. Paul Rudish is probably.
That whole group. I'm hugging my heart for Paul. But I learned more about animation listening to Larry as he was going through. The overseas studio would send back the layouts that they had done to get feedback, to get notes. So this is all like shipping massive amounts of paper. And then they would be given to Paul. This is on Two Stupid Dogs and Super Secret Secret Squirrel. Actually it was more on Super Secret Squirrel because the other ones went to another studio. But the Super Secret ones would come back and Paul Rudish would go through and, through the layouts and do little sketches.
He had 24 hours. Yeah. Couldn't spend any more time than that.
Holy shit.
And put a post-it note on something Larry, after Paul was finished, they come back to Larry and Larry would flip through to see what he had done. And one time I walked in and he was just sitting and he was saying, this guy is so great. this is just amazing. Look at what he did here. And I asked, what are you looking at? And he would show me, Larry would show me, he would lift up the post-it note to show what the drawing looked like from overseas,
mm-hmm.
put Paul's correction on it. And it would be things like just the expression that there was acting at it. Like it would be a perfectly okay drawing, but there mm-hmm. wasn't anything about like what's happening in the story at that point. And it might be like lowering the eyebrows a little than what was there, but it made this huge difference in that whole layout and how it felt.
Paul's acting as this art director there mm-hmm. when it came back. We didn't have that name, but he was so head of layout, so to speak. And one of the things he did, and I caught it, and I'm like, oh, of course, is that all he did was he shifted, he cut it out, and he shifted the whole screen slightly to the right. And the reason mm-hmm. he did that was he didn't want the characters performing directly in front of the picture frame that was right behind it, hanging up on the wall, because it made a separate screen. So he moved a little bit to the right or the left, I can't remember what it is, so that there would be, it wouldn't draw attention to itself. And he did that several times on the set. He didn't want the background elements to be so prominent mm-hmm. when all it was just be a screen to animate, take the animation that was being done and put that in the foreground. And he did that so often, I just said, well, you know, he just touches something once mm-hmm. and he's changed the way the whole picture is going to look when it gets back.
And it did make a difference.
But boy, he cost us money. I'm telling you. One of the things that they asked for on that one show, the villain was a chameleon. Mm-hmm. And he would hide amongst the pictures in an art display like this. And so it would be Renoir here and here over there. It would be Picasso and you're like this. And mm-hmm. and he'd take on the characters and then he would come up and step in front and then form something else. And I said, you know, that is not going to work. They're not going to know what you're talking about. Remember, this is not Europe. He says, these people are in Asia. So they don't even know necessarily what Asian art works unless they happen to get an encyclopedia and drop it in their lap. I says, no. The only way this is going to work is you've got to send them keys. They got to have painted keys. And they said, well, that's silly. There's at least 20. And they said, you going to do that? There's 16 different keys you'd have to do to get the artwork right. I said, oh, my God. We have to pay for 16 pixels. Keep my own damn mouth shut. But we did. And it looked great. My favorite show. One of my favorite shows.
Roddy McDowell did the voice of the chameleon.
Yeah, that was great.
It was great.
This is great.
With his British accent.
That's really cool. Thank you for sharing that. And I don't know if you guys have gotten the chance to see on old Disney Plus, man, but have you gotten to see his Mickey shorts?
Yes, yeah. I love them. That's Paul.
Oh, they're so good. Yes, yes, they're so good.
Alex Kerwin. They're the mm-hmm. ones that show. And there were buds, but lost Alex to Disney. Loved Alex. Alex,
I've been
Duluth, Minnesota.
Alex was another one who was like 17 when Larry first started working with him.
I loved it. I wanted to authorize him as the first. They were doing everybody was supposed to send a storyboard, five minutes or so, just to see how it was going to work out. I loved what he did right away, mm-hmm. and I would have given him the first thing, but it went to somebody unknown like Seth MacFarlane. At that time was very unknown.
Man, I just watched Larry and Steve for the first time in shit 10 years at the very least, because I'll go back in time and I'll just want to reminisce about the good old days of being a kid, and I'll just go on YouTube, and there was one channel before it got pulled down, I think once the Time Warner merger happened, or not Time Warner, excuse me, what was it, the Discovery merger that happened just a couple of years ago. They just started hitting like every channel and pulling things down. So now you got to go from channel to channel to channel to see the entire, what was it, like 50, 52, whatever it was, those original shorts. But before, I could just put it on and stay up from 9 o'clock when all my family goes to sleep until about 3-4 o'clock before I was like, all right, I got to go get at least an hour or two of sleep, you know what I mean? And just watch them all. But, you know, getting to see those ones. But with that being said, it says, the shorts you were talking about, you know, so No Smoking hits, right? So with Cow and Chicken, David animates it almost entirely by himself, if not entirely by himself. What were your initial thoughts when he first screened? Do you remember how old he was? I know you said when you met him, he was 17. So he was working on Two Stupid Dogs. So he's probably what, in his 20s by the time Cow and Chicken starting?
Yeah, he had been around. He had gone to animate in Spain or something. Well, yeah. In the interim period between 17 and.
He went to Spain and he also went to Brazil. Columbia, for God's sake. I'm middle of the riot, as a matter of fact.
Jesus.
There's a historian, Nancy Grimaldi, oh, who yeah. was one of the executive secretaries. And she talked about
David
calling about, was it, yeah. Calling from Columbia, or maybe I'm thinking about Bob.
Well, they were there together.
They were there. Oh God! But she, Ginger, who Nancy was talking to, could hear gunshots in the background.
Machine gun fire.
Is somebody shooting? Yeah.
It's just another day in Columbia.
What? It was crazy.
David was very frightened. He just packed up and went home. He said, "Screw this."
Yeah, he worked for a chunk of time between 17 and when he came onto Super Secret, Secret Squirrel. So, you know, they weren't abutted. He went to and, you know, was pretty, I would say he was maybe 27, yeah. something yeah. like that. About 10 years before he found, before the Two Stupid Dogs and Super Secret, Secret Squirrel stuff. Probably about and then Larry telling him about the shorts program, you gotta get something together so that you know you have
I thought it was a near perfect short.
Yeah.
No Smoking. I watched it over and over and over just for pleasure on myself. And of course, you know, having Charlie Adler do the voice. We had some problems with it, only because of the fact that we couldn't use the word devil. So yeah, you can still use the word hell, but you couldn't use the word devil. It's obviously the devil. Why would you have this argument? They had an argument about it. So, big red guy. Mm-hmm. That was me.
Yeah, red guy.
I gave him that title. I said, "Let's call him the big red guy." Everybody loved that because it was stupid. So that's what went on. And Charlie got extra money every time somebody mentioned the big red guy. He said, "Oh, yeah. Well, sure, I'll make some money," because he did it that way. He did a lot of show. He did a lot of voices on that show, though.
Yeah,
I think he did. Him and Dee Bradley Baker were like the two biggest. I think Dee Bradley did probably the two adults, the mom and the dad, and then Charlie did everybody: Cow, Chicken, Red Guy. I think he did Boneless Chick. He did a lot of people on that show.
Yeah, that was his. It was his show.
That was one of the on that episode, and it was true of a lot with David stuff, and for me, and it's always a good sign when I laugh at the storyboard. If I laugh out loud at the storyboard, and that was one of them. And on the series, once it went into series, there would be times where I would be laughing out loud at the storyboard. And it just, you know, the expressions on people's faces, the one, and it's in the, in that, it's kind of a pilot, but it's not, it's the first show. Short where Chicken tells Cow to stop acting stupid is what he says, and then he yells at the parents, you know, "Mom, Dad, Cow's acting stupid," and the parents say, "Cow, are you acting stupid?"
No.
And she says, "No, he was acting stupid with me." And you don't see her, you just hear the voice, but the expression on Chicken's face when she says that, it's like, so funny. She's lying. I don't know. Those moments in there are just, you know, how does he come up with that stuff? I don't know. But I would sit there and laugh. And that, and I like, did you know that the show was originally called Cow and Chicken Go to Hell?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. David had brought it up the first time I talked to him, because I asked him, I'm like, how the hell do you come up with that? And he was like, well, this is a story I came up with to get my daughter to go to sleep. And then he explained the whole thing, and I'm like, dude, my mom read Dr. Seuss to me as a kid. My mom didn't tell me about a cow and a chicken and a devil that was trying to take chicken's soul from him. I was like, can you be my dad? You know what I mean? It's just like, I want stories like this.
Don't do it, chicken. It's
not what you do. That was from
have you gotten to talk to Charlie lately or recently at all? Charlie mm-hmm. Adler? No.
We've had
how's he doing?
Lunch with
doing
him
good.
Recently. You how is he doing?
Oh, he's doing good. I had him on about 2 years ago, and I'm always amazed at how quickly he so somebody wrote in, because I always ask for questions, and so a fan wrote in, especially in the early days. They were like, can you see if Charlie, he was like, this is a weird request, I know. It's probably one of my favorite questions of all time. He's like, it's a weird request, but can you have him sing Hey Mickey, You're So Fine, You're So Fine, Hey Mickey, as the red guy? And I was like, Charlie, and I hit pause. I'm like, I've got a really weird question from somebody. And I was like, I just want to see if you'll go for it. He's like, well, what is it? And he was like, but hit record, play it on record. So I did. And I was like, this guy really wanted to know, can you sing Hey Mickey, You're So Fine as the red guy? And boy, oh boy, I'll send you guys the clip. Charlie does not disappoint. You see him morph, right? He just hit his shoulders roll, and then he just gets into it. And it's just him as the red guy singing that great 80s song. And I'm just like, this guy is amazing. He is everything that's advertised and then some. It was just so cool getting to see him just transform into that character he played 30 years ago.
He's an artist too.
Yeah. It was
graphic artist.
Oh, really? Oh, that's right. I forgot about that, because, you know, he'll post some stuff every once in a while. He does a lot of paintings and stuff like that. Yeah, so it was really cool, like I said, getting to see him transform into that. Now, with that being said, I think it's crazy, and I told David this, and I told Fred this too, it's crazy that they had an issue with the devil, but they didn't have an issue with seeing a chicken smoke on TV that was made for 10 and under. That show was made for, I think it was Y7 was the age bracket they stuck on that one. But smoking, that one was okay.
Come on. Who's seen a chicken smoke? Let's say they left them in the roaster too long. That's it. I mean, you know, they just don't smoke.
Let me put it this way. I've got family members that are from West Virginia. I've seen some chicken smoke in my day. I'm just saying. There's nothing that I don't say there's nothing I haven't seen, because there's a lot of stuff I haven't seen. But I've seen some of my cousins do some really crazy shit, and I've seen a chicken with a cigarette in his mouth.
I've seen some of your West Virginia boys do crazy shit here. So
I'm not West Virginia, I'm Florida, so we're on our own type of crazy. But like I said, they showed me some really crazy shit on the farm every time I would go up there. So, but yeah, man. So the chicken short hit, or cow and chicken short, it hits. It's obviously a success, because it's one of those, what was it, 5 or 6 original pilots that were aired on the What a Cartoon that made it. They were the ones picked up for series. When it's picked up for series, what's that?
It was the second one.
Disney
Show was first, Dexter's Lab. Mm-hmm. And then the next one to roll out into series was Cow and Chicken.
Did you guys know, like, as soon as you saw the short, the pilot, they're like, oh, this one's getting picked up for sure?
My reaction, again, because I laughed at Dexter's Lab, too, looking at the storyboard. That's my gut feeling. Like, I really like, this is very, very funny. This is, and they're, again, same with Powerpuff Girls. I laughed at the board, so...
I being a producer on the show, of those shows, they asked me from Cartoon Network, Atlanta, of all the shows that shorts you've seen so far, who do you think should be put in the thing? And I said, Dexter's Lab and Powerpuff Girls.
Mm-hmm.
Those are the two. Then there's a big pause. Everybody says that. I said, well, then that's why aren't you listening? I mean, we have to put those in. Well, somebody here doesn't like the show. I can see that, but I'm telling you, it's a no-brainer. You know, that's where you go with it.
And then Cow and Chicken. And the ones that I thought would make it, made it. The Dexter, Cow and Chicken. I didn't know about the order, but as far as which ones. And I think it's more, you've talked about this sometime, that there is a sense of you can almost see other stories that haven't been, they're not, they don't exist, mm-hmm. but you have the sense of those characters can go on and have stories together. And those, you know, those three for me were the Cow, you know, Cow and Chicken, Dexter, and Powerpuff Girls.
Now, Dexter's Lab was, when we started up the story, the first program, they were looking for people, and I had already seen Genndy Kartikoff's storyboards. I saw the storyboard, but I also saw his portfolio that he did at CalArts, and he had dreams to get a job animating at Disney.
Yeah,
and I saw his little short pencil test that he did on Didi dancing of the a ballet, you know, like this, and then look at his pitch for the short, which was all done in storyboard form. And I said, well, afterwards, I said, well, let's bring that on and bring it to Fruitation and do it as a short. He says, no, I kind of want to stick my guns and go over to Disney and become an animator. And there's a long pause. I'm thinking, why would you want to do that? I said, well, it's Disney. And I said, I get it. I mean, I understand the allure of Disney. I said, it allured me. And I said, but what I'm telling you is that this is a short that your major self, and you're going to have complete control of the actual making of the short, short of the budget. And I said, and you can do it now and then go to Disney's later. Why would you want to do that? Later on, somebody talked to him and said, are you nuts? You know, this is nobody's getting this kind of opportunity. Why don't you do it? So he did it, and the rest is history. But he never went back to Disney. Never went to Disney afterwards, but he ended up animating on a lot of pictures. So and of course doing a lot of shorts. I mean, the Star Wars thing was a big deal. That they looked and he called him up and said, no, I want you for this project. And so from that point on, Genndy was getting richer than me.
But it's safe to say Genndy might not have gotten to work at Disney, but I don't think that door's closed forever. That guy, he's got like G14 classification. He can go anywhere, man. He can do anything. I mean, there's that whole wave of creators you guys have mentioned, him, Craig, David, especially. You know, those guys are they're like Mount Rushmore to almost everybody that grew up with this stuff. It's just seeing those guys, it's like that was our childhood. You guys had a huge part in that too, with helping shape and mold these young men and women that were coming through those doors, whether they're an animator, whether they're a writer, whether they were a background painter, whether they're, you know, character design, it didn't matter what it did. You guys were there at the inception, helping mold and push them into the directions and fit them into the holes and squares and triangles that they needed to go into to make sure Cartoon Network had the foundation to stand up on itself and create and create and create. And that's what it did. Created my childhood, created so many other people's childhoods. And we all have an undying thank you to give to both of you guys for helping usher in the greatest cartoon era in my lifetime. And I'll go down to say this. This is, everybody thinks of the golden animation or the golden years of animation, one of the 30s, the 40s, the 50s, you know, Fleischer and early Disney and this and that. Now, the golden animation for me is about 91 to 92. till about 2005, 2006, and you guys were a huge part of that. So from me to you, I thank you both so much for your contributions to animation.
Oh, thank you.
Well, as we wind down here, there are a couple questions that I like to ask, especially when we talk about something so important like Cow and Chicken and Cartoon Network. Now, Sylvia, we'll start with you, ladies first. So when you think of that term, Cartoon Network, and this is a two-parter, so I'll give you both so you can think about both. But when you think about that term Cartoon Network and you think about that show Cow and Chicken, what are the first words, first thoughts, first emotions that are evoked when you think about that?
I think my first thoughts are always in the couched in that, like, Cartoon Network did not exist when those things started. They had a contest internally as far as what do we call it and what do we call, you know, what a cartoon. It didn't have a name. And then Cartoon Network may have existed in the lexicon of people at a higher level than I was, but for me, they were the shorts. And, you know, when I heard about, you know, and when I see the shows that I worked on, I always think of them in terms of what a cartoon. And Fred, again, going back to Fred is bold. Fred will go forward too, where there's nobody else. There is nobody else creating this. When Larry would talk with, you know, the kids about, you should put the, you know, you have, this is, you know, it's a piece of animation, but it's got possibilities. You should put something together so that they can see it, you know, really encouraging. But Fred was the one, Fred Seibert was the one who was looking into this area where nothing it was being done anymore. They used to do it when they made cartoons for the front of movies, you know, kind of little, or in between movies, I guess. But those days were gone. And Fred was the one who was like, nobody's doing anything over there. Let's go. It really, and it took that. And it took somebody at that level who, it was all this timing. That's what I think of. It has to do with this convergence of somebody who had the courage to do it, comes in, you know, comes into this studio where he says, I don't know what I'm doing. I don't know anything about animation. And there's somebody there who says, wow, somebody who says he doesn't know what he's doing. Justin gets excited, you know, about coming on board. And then it turns out this same guy also has this idea of, we should be doing those short cartoons that they used to have in the front of movies. Nobody's doing that. A whole empty area because nobody could think about how do you get this funding to work. And then he has an animation person who's like, you know, walks past a doorway and sees a drawing on the and says, wow, that is really cool. And, you know, I don't know, all of this convergent. And then the little old lady who decided, you know, I'm going to take away from teaching. I can do a sabbatical. I'll have my job when I come back, but I need to do this production thing. Just all of these, along with the kids who were working on Two Stupid Dogs and Secret Secret Squirrel, you know, they're all in there, and, you know, these elements that all came together at this one point. And Bill Hanna and Joe Barbera are still around and coming to the studio every day. It really feels almost magical to me. Mm. I still feel that way about it all this time later. And now that's 30 years ago that all of this, it was 92. September of 92 is where I started my internship. And that my first gig for Margot McDonough was to do, you know, get addresses and phone numbers and do cold calls to, you know, animation departments and art departments and colleges to say, we're doing the shorts program and we got a program and maybe your students will want to do it. Can we send you a batch of flyers? It just feels very like unseen hands to me saying, oh, over here, and calling Leanne and saying, do you take interns that are just doing junior college credits? Sure. it just has this very magical quality to me.
Yeah.
I never can get past that. And again, it's over, you know, it's 30 plus years now since any of that happened. 32 years.
What about you, Larry? What do you think about when you think about all the shorts you got to work on, all the people you got to help and mold? What do you think about when you think about Cow and Chicken and Cartoon Network?
Well, they never write, they never call. They never send you. I don't get anything.
How dare you, meet people, and he's talking about right now. How dare you?
But I myself have been very blessed with that opportunity. And we've all been blessed having Sylvia into the business because she quit me and went someplace else. She went to HBO after that and then went to Disney. They were all over the place. It took forever for her to circle back out of work.
For one reason, as far as Larry, along with a couple other people, Larry, Mario Peluso, all, you know, these people who I would talk to about, like, I want to learn more about. I think I want to. Well, Sylvia, you might have to go somewhere else. You might have to quit this and go into, that's this business. You go studio to studio. It's not, it's an industry. It's not that you stay. You just have to decide when it's time. And then, you know, go and, you know, wherever you are next time will be the place where you learn this thing that you say you want to learn. So I interrupted you. I'm sorry.
Again, I do that a lot. Yeah, so I'm going to say nothing new here, folks. Well, it was never done. I, having been at Hanna-Barbera for a number of years and other studios in the business before that, nobody does that. We have a couple of guys like, you know, Bill and Joe, you know, mm-hmm. a couple of guys like the Spears and
Ruby Spears. Yeah.
We get together and they Ken make Spears. All the projects. They do all the development. They do all the stories. And nobody else gets a shot at that. Nobody walks in the door with the project, with the exception of David Kirshner. I was working at Ruby Spears when David Kirshner worked in the door and said, I'd like to do a show called Cricket Thicket.
Cricket Thicket.
And it started with a bunch of flowers that could talk and sing and everything like this. And it really wasn't overtly enthusiastic about it, but Bill and Joe were looking at him and he's going on and on with this thing.
Or Ken.
Ken is, yeah. Well, Ken.
Ken Spears. And
yeah, Ken Spears.
But it was Joe Ruby.
Joe Ruby.
Joe Ruby was inside. So they're listening, they're partners. And they're saying, well, you know, it's nice, he said, but, you know, we're going to have to start all over from scratch here and try and get the network interested. And quite frankly, why would we do what we do? Why would we let you do what we do? Because, well, I don't know. I said, I walked in here with a pre-sold project at Hallmark, and I got a bag full of money from such and such down here like that. And they all went looking at it. Mr. Kirshner, step right into this next room here. And the next thing, he's up and doing, running, and we started taking that seriously. Yeah, but he was first into my room, and I'm like, dear God, you know, like this. But
now he was in charge when I did my internship.
Yes, by that time, Hanna-Barbera had been moved over to David Kirshner.
Okay.
Who was doing a lot of stuff that didn't work.
So. Cats Don't Dance. And
no, he didn't.
Pagemaster.
Pagemaster, he did. And he did.
Cats Don't Dance was there too.
No.
Yeah.
Cats Don't Dance, I think, was a different show. Dindal was there.
But Kirshner was. They were working on that when I came on board. I remember people talking about it.
Maybe so. Maybe so.
Yeah.
Who knows?
I think so.
She's my better memory, but but yeah, David brought me over to work on
Fish Police.
And it was Dave's dalliance into primetime television.
Dave Kirshner.
Dave.
Yeah.
think that was a Dave Kirshner.
Well, but David Feese is also who we're talking about. Huh? There's too many Daves in this conversation.
No, that's I like hearing history because I usually set it up wherever the conversation goes, because all these stories, like I said, are going to trigger a whole bunch of memories you guys probably haven't thought about in a long time. They're going to trigger a whole bunch of stories, and you guys will sit there. Well, you guys will sit there and you'll have each other to bounce stories off of. You're like, oh shit, we forgot all about this stuff. So like I said, the next time we talk, we're going to have even more stuff to talk about and reflect on. But like I said, it's been a blast getting to walk down memory lane with both of you guys, getting to hear the stories. Oh, go ahead. Yeah.
As far as when you talked with David, and have you talked with Bill Burnett?
I have not, no.
Oh, okay.
Bill Burnett was
on the first season of Cow and Chicken as the lead writer.
Oh, that's true.
It was Bill Burnett.
I'm gonna step out. She's stepping out. Well, the other guys were being off.
He will return.
Oh, no worries.
This is when after the pilot, and it, you know, it goes on the air, and then they decide after Dexter what's gonna roll out, and it's gonna be Cow and Chicken. The writing team, so David at the helm, David Feese, and then Bill Burnett, Seth MacFarlane, and Richard Purcell were the main people in that first season that we did. There may have been some freelancers too. I don't remember exactly, but that was the team that. And most of the time with those shows, this was true of Dexter. This was true of Cow and Chicken. True of Powerpuff Girls. They come from. You do the board first, like a thumbnail board.
Yeah.
Or you start with an outline. It's just hammering story ideas. There's an outline. There's no script to start with. Just the idea of what that story is going to be in the outline. And then it goes to storyboard from the outline, not from a script. And then I think they did that same thing on Cow and Chicken. They would hammer out story ideas and then write an outline, which was maybe 2-3 pages long at the most. And then it would go, you know, it would be board. And I think David did the boards, if not all of them.
It wouldn't surprise me. I mean, just talking to him, he told me it was a board-driven show. That way, you know, the everything from the gags, they would have, like you said, the 2-page outline, but it was the majority of the gags, the jokes, anything like that were coming from the board artists. There was a lot of Cartoon Network during that era was very heavy into the board-driven show. They wanted to give the, not so much the control, but like the freedom back to the artists that were making these shows like they did so many years ago.
Yeah. And when it's a dialogue driven show, then as far as writing a script, sure. And if the writer is at the head.
Yeah.
But as far as the, you know, that was the other advantage for me, was coming into something where they were doing board driven shows. And I thought that's what it was for the longest time. I didn't work on anything where there was a script first for years.
Yeah. Gotcha. Yeah.
Oh, I liked it. Sitting in a room and they, you know, what did they call that? The sweat box.
editing?
The sweat box for stories. Like the going back to, what was it, in Warner Brothers, Termite Terrace. Where you sit and you just throw ideas around, which was just funny. And I, in my, you know, sitting and taking notes, not shorthand, taking notes during the session, I would, I still remember with sitting, go into Larry's office. I would be sitting on the sofa. Most of the time, Craig McCracken was sitting next to me. And, you know, everybody is throwing ideas around. This is on Two Stupid Dogs. No, actually, maybe it was Dexter that I remember this more than anything else. Throwing around, here's this notion. You know, Dexter keeps being told he can't do something because he's too young. And everybody says, wait till you're older. Wait till you're older.
And grows then, the beard.
Yeah. And they'd be throwing story ideas around. And Craig would mutter things under his breath that nobody else could hear. And I'm writing, and I'd start laughing because he would say these, you know, things that were perfect. And then he would go ahead and say it out to the group. I loved that. That was such, you know, something that, and that was the whole point, was just to make something that was funny. And Cow and Chicken the same way. When I was in, I was actually at HBO by this time, and Cow and Chicken was on its second season. And so I was not there, but HBO sent me to have, it was not training exactly, but like leadership shop. And they sent it, and it was in Sacramento. And so I set up an extra day that I could stay so that I could go and see David. And I'd always wanted to see his setup because he had his home where he lived, and then he had a different house that was the office that he shared with, was that his brother-in-law?
Hell, I don't remember that. I wasn't there.
But he worked with him. I think it was his brother-in-law.
I don't know.
I don't know who. I'm sorry, I don't remember the man's name. But he and David worked together, and there's this house, and it's set up it's still a house, but it's set up, you know, it's got animation tables and places to have. And I always wanted to see it, so I go, and we set up having lunch, and David and his wife and his two kids and I were going to go to lunch at a restaurant nearby. As we're in the car, I forget what happened. The kids were at this stage. That's these stories that came out. His daughter starts calling Dave Jr. Bermuda. And everything she would say would be, you know, I like that. Do you like it, Bermuda? And she would just, and I just said, that sounds like a Cow and Chicken episode. And David said, it does. And I don't know if it ever got made into an episode.
Sounds like it to me.
But it sounded like a Cow and Chicken episode where, you know, she just out of the blue, and I have no idea why she chose Bermuda, but as far as like, and drive, you know, cow driving chicken crazy.
Oh yeah.
This little thing just to get under his skin. And even his son had to laugh, as far as he was trying very hard not to, but even he thought, as far as like, it does sound like a Cow and Chicken episode. But I meander.
You do.
I meander. All sorts of good memories back.
You learn it all?
Will. it'll. I promise you, it'll all come back. You guys, like I said, we'll talk about this over the next couple of days. Well, like I said, man, I think we did the groundwork for having you guys back on for a part two. So if you guys are up for it, I'd love to have you back on. Like I said, thank you for taking me. Anytime I can sit back and get to hear the stories that you don't get to hear. That's what I find so disheartening about not having physical media anymore. I used to buy DVDs just so I could watch the director's cut, the bonus features. Hearing you guys, folks like yourself, talk about a scene or talk about these stories. You know, I love being able to just sit back, relax, and then get to hear the piece of my childhood that hasn't been glamorized until, and with the exception of like the last decade or so, you're starting to see more of you guys come on shows like this and really be able to like let your hair down and just go with these stories that we want to hear about production, about David, about yourselves, about Craig, and about all these fun times that we didn't get to witness. What it would have been like to be a fly on the wall for some of those pitches, for some of those storyboards, because you get to see them now where people record them and put storyboard pitches up, but get to see it back in the day where there was, with the exception of calling the devil, there was really nothing that they blocked off, right? And so, you know, I would have loved to see that. But this is just as good getting to hear it from you guys. So thank you guys for spending a little bit of time with me. I really appreciate it. No better way to end this than she's been Sylvia, he's been Larry, I've been Julian. This has been the What's in My Head podcast, and this has been another piece of your childhood. Good night.
Hey guys, it's your resident cartoon junkie Brandon Jones here asking you to have a listen to my Animation Destination podcast. It's an animation celebration podcast, and it's full of all sorts of stuff about anime and cartoons and voice acting and all that sort of thing, and just a really all-around celebration of anything animated. So come on by and check it out. We've got fan episodes of your favorite animes to your most obscure cartoons on Netflix that no one's ever heard of. And just really love talking about it. You can subscribe to us on Spotify and iTunes and anywhere else you can get your podcasts from. So stop on by, subscribe, and stay tuned for the Animation Destination Podcast.
Hey guys, thanks for listening. Before we go, thank you so much for spending a little bit of time with the podcast today. I truly appreciate every download and listen we get. If you're liking what we're doing, drop us a 5-star rating, drop us a review, tell a friend, and I'll see you next week.